The show is live and local. It's your connection to local music and more. And the second portion of our program, we'll be talking with Philip Yampolsky, who is director of the Robert E. Brown Center for World Music. They're giving their spring concert Saturday afternoon in two portions, actually. And we also have some of the performers on that program, the Shona Mbira Ensemble, or members of it, directed by Tom Torino. Tom's with us, and he'll also be playing a Peruvian music on that portion of our show. First portion of the show, we'll be talking with Jennifer Williams Brown, who is a professor of music at Grinnell College in Iowa, and she's also the editor of an opera by Francesco Cavalli called La Callisto, which is opening at the Krannert Center tonight, being put on by the University of Illinois Opera Program, and it runs through Sunday. So we're going to hear a bit about what it means to create an edition of an opera. And also we'll hear about that opera itself. It's live and local. Stay with us on FM 90.9. We just heard part of the prologue from an opera called La Callisto by Francesco Cavalli, and this is a performance given by the Concerto Vocale led by Rene Jacobs. This piece is going to be performed in its entirety by the University of Illinois Opera Program. It opens tonight at 7:30 with performances on Friday and Saturday at the same time, and then on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. They're all at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in the Tryon Festival Theater. And it's kind of an interesting conversation I think we're going to have, because my guest is the editor of this version of La Callisto by Cavalli. And I was reading a bit by her. Her name is Jennifer Williams Brown, professor of music at Grinnell College, and also class of 1978 at University of Illinois. And it says that right here on these notes to Callisto. I hope I didn't give anything away there.
I'm proud of my U of I connection.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of the date and so on. Some people get sensitive to that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Best be quiet about that.
But you comment here in these notes on this opera a lot about Cavalli himself, that he had a lot to do with opera becoming this cultural phenomenon that it has become today, which is maybe in itself a revelation that, oh, opera wasn't always a big thing?
Yes, actually, opera was one of the few genres of music in history that was very self-consciously invented by a group of scholars, musicians, and noblemen in Italy at the end of the 16th century. And they wanted to try to return to some of the ideals of the ancient Greeks, and this was a time of a lot of exploration of actual ancient Greek texts, and so they conceived the notion that the ancient Greek dramas were actually sung instead of spoken, and also saw that the ancient Greek writers talked about how music could move the listeners to have intense emotions that they weren't intending to feel, but they were inspired to feel by the drama and the music being played out in front of them. And so these opera creators, they're known to music historians as the camerata, tried to figure out what was wrong with the current state of music and find solutions to this. And so we have, the landmark date that people often use is the year 1600, when the first opera that we have the whole thing of was performed in Florence. This is Euridice by Jacopo Peri, and this was actually the focus of a conference at the University of Illinois in the year 2000, the 400th anniversary of that moment of the invention of opera. But In the very earliest days of opera, it was sort of a rarefied event, one of many types of musical theatrical extravaganzas that were being put on by noblemen and by intellectuals that were trying to do something innovative and experimental, but it was not something that most people had any exposure to because they were not invited. And so something very novel happened in 1637 in Venice, the amazing invention of the concept of public opera, that is the concept that you buy a ticket, and if you can afford the money for a ticket, you can go into the show. To us, that seems very straightforward. This is how almost all of our music making is done today. But this was a new idea in the period. And so once there was some kind of a financial apparatus tied to the creation of opera, people started thinking, oh, you don't have to have a wealthy court that's going to subsidize all of this at huge expense. It can be a business. And so Cavalli was one of the first people to get in on the ground floor, as it were. He went into the opera business a year after the very first theater opened and produced his first opera the year after that. And after that point, he cranked them out pretty regularly in Venice. He was the leading composer of opera in Venice. And La Callisto was premiered in 1651. I think it was his 11th opera. Something like that.
And you wrote also that he eventually became the most performed opera composer of the 17th century, period? Did I
read
that right?
Well, Italian composer.
Italian composer.
But I think that probably means, I think that would probably extend to other countries as well, because it took a very long time before opera caught on in other countries. France, it was only in the 1670s. Germany, the same. England really never developed a tradition of opera in the 17th century. It was only something that happened in the 18th century. And so opera was essentially Italian opera in the 17th century, and it spread out from Venice. Venice was the center, and then other cities decided they wanted to put on operas, and so they wrote to Venice and got copies of Cavalli's operas, went on the road with them, and eventually settled down in other cities, and eventually other composers in those cities started writing opera. But initially, it was revivals of works by people like Cavalli that were leading the way. And so
you comment in these notes that Monteverdi's the guy who got all the glory.
Monteverdi does tend to hog a lot of the airtime, airspace in the discussions of 17th century music. He's my favorite composer. This is how I got into Cavalli, was studying Monteverdi. But Monteverdi, he wrote a number of musical dramatic works, but a lot of them are lost. And so if you really want to study opera from this period, you're trapped by the fact that you can only work with documents that survive. We obviously don't have any recordings from the period. And
so when you say lost, you mean literally nobody has the music anymore.
Yeah.
It's
music
just who
is
knows
gone.
Where it is.
Yeah.
But we have
it was
evidence that
burned
it was
for
there.
Fuel at some point or yeah. something. I don't know. Lost in a flood in Venice. Who knows?
Well, they didn't have electricity back then, so they had to fire up something.
That's
right.
Right.
Might as well use pieces
of
opera.
And if you also consider that all of the theaters were made of wood and they were lit by candlelight, that explains a lot about the state of 17th century opera. But Cavalli was very self-conscious in a way about his legacy, and he kept a personal library of his scores, and he had some very fancy copies of them made. And some of these were obtained after his death by collectors. And we end up with a collection of 30 manuscripts today that came from Cavalli's own library. And Callisto is one of those. And so that provides a nice body of material that we can study.
So he made things easy on biographers. Relatively speaking.
Relatively speaking, compared to other composers of his day that were perhaps in some ways, initially more famous, but We don't know anything about them because their music is lost.
But there's evidence that they existed and that their operas happened were performed and
so
on.
We're fortunate that in most cases a libretto, the text, the script of the opera survives, was printed, but the music is usually lost.
So tell the story of La Callisto. Who or what is La Callisto, the title character?
Yes,
is that the right
term?
She
is a character, yes. Callisto, this is a story from ancient mythology, and the Callisto story derives from Ovid. It's the story of the nymph Callisto, who is a sworn follower of the goddess Diana, who is the goddess of the hunt, the goddess of the moon, but also the goddess of virginity. And so Callisto has taken an oath of virginity. Well, then we have Jove, or Jupiter, or Zeus, the king of the gods, who comes down from heaven and is wandering around with his henchman Mercury, and he spies the beautiful nymph Callisto and decides that he would like to have his way with her, and she will have nothing to do with him. And she stalks off indignantly, and he scratches his head and tries to figure out, well, how can I make this girl love me? And Mercury, who is the god of deception, says, well, okay, she's sworn to obey every command of her goddess Diana, and therefore, if you transform yourself into Diana and say, come with me into the bushes, then, of course, she's going to have to do it because she's taken this oath. So that's exactly what happens. And Jove turns himself into Diana, and Callisto is very happy to oblige, and the rest of the opera ensues from there. Lots of complications in this plot.
You know, yesterday we had a brief segment on Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, and the folks from Ransell Theater Group said, you know, it's just like a soap opera, and this kind of sounds that way too, a mythological
absolutely.
Soap opera.
I think there are certain aspects of human nature that never grow old in terms of their relevance to the way that we behave. We fall in love, we betray each other, we have fun, we reconcile at the end, and it all happens in spades in this opera.
We take revenge.
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. And so revenge is another part of this drama. Of course, Jove is not exactly a bachelor god. He is married to the queen of the gods, Juno. And she gets wind of what's going on and comes down to Earth to spy on her husband. And, of course, the first person she meets is Callisto, who tells her this sad story. Diana took me in the woods and she kissed me. And now when I go up to Diana, she doesn't know who I am and I don't understand what's going on. And Juno very quickly figures out that it's her husband who has changed himself into Diana. And so, long story short, she takes her revenge on Callisto and turns her into a bear.
Why not?
Yes. Well, okay. Well, you'll understand why. It's all part of trying to understand the larger cosmos. And so Jove cannot undo the curse that Juno has put on Callisto. But what he can do is make her immortal. And so at the end of the opera, he elevates her to the heavens as a constellation. And this is the constellation that we know as the Great Bear.
So I have a question. This might bring this into the realm that some of our listeners may recognize. Is there a relationship between this character of Callisto and the Callisto who shows up in one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies?
Goodness gracious, I have no idea. I have seen those movies, but there's so many characters I don't remember.
And I forget which one that's in. Well, I'll have to, when I saw when I first saw the name of this opera, which I hadn't heard of before myself, that's the first thing that I wondered. And I never understood it from the film. Who is this woman? Because that in itself seems like...
I will have to go back and watch. I mean, I think that in some ways, a movie like Pirates of Caribbean has more in common with the plots of a 17th century opera than a lot of other, we might think, more serious musical works that are produced today. That's that complexity and the twists and turns of the plot that were all very much part of what people went to the opera in this period for. It's just they know the story. because they've all read Ovid, and these stories have been around for thousands of years. But just seeing what this librettist does with it, and little the how he gets himself into, how Jove gets himself into hot water, and how he gets out of it. That's the trick that the librettist plays on the audience.
Let's hear a bit more from the opera itself. We have queued up here, I think you told me, was it scene track 12?
Track 12, yes. This is the scene where Jove has just turned himself into Diana, and he is approaching Callisto saying, "Hello, how are you? I haven't seen you in a while, and wouldn't you like to go into the bushes?" And at the end, they go off, they sing a little duet, skipping away, saying, "Let's go kissing, let's go kissing." Okay.
That's a nice summary. And it's just sung here by members of Concerto Vocale, led by Renee Jacobs, music from La Callisto by Francesco Cavalli, which is being put on by the University of Illinois Opera Program, opening tonight. And we're talking with the editor of this particular edition, Jennifer Williams Brown, here on Live and Local.
Chi non ti crederebbe agli arresi, alla forma, al portamento, la dea del ciel d'argento. Ecco l'orgoglio setta colta in... Va pur, va pur, va seco, altro che suon di casti.
That comes from the opera La Callisto by Francesco Cavalli with members of Concerto Vocale led by Renee Jacobs. That is scene 5, which Jennifer Williams Brown described quite colorfully just a bit ago. And she's the editor of the version of the opera that the UVI Opera Program is doing starting tonight. It opens tonight. Ricardo Herrera is directing. Charlotte Maddox-Mersch is the conductor. She's also a director of Concerto Urbano, which I don't know if they're necessarily the ensemble, but certainly players from the university are in the pit. So what does it mean to make an edition of opera, and why was there one necessary for this?
Well, if you ever saw the manuscript, the only surviving musical source that comes from Cavalli's period, you would know immediately why we need a modern edition of it, because it's a mess.
Is this sort of like can't read a doctor's writing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And also, it's actually at the core of it is a neat copy of the music. Copied in part by Francesco's wife, Maria, who was one of his principal copyists, which is an interesting topic in and of itself. And I'll be giving a talk later on this afternoon at the School of Music on that subject. But on top of this neat copy are tons of revisions that were made in the process of performing the opera. So the opera was not a fixed thing. It was constantly responding to various changes that were happening. Notably, the serious change that happened was that the lead singer in the role of Endymion died. And therefore, they had to find another singer to do the role. But they didn't find a singer with the same voice type. This new guy was a soprano, so Cavalli had to rewrite the role. And you can see there are lots of crossings out and transpositions and new bits of stuff that are added over. And
transpositions meaning you change from one key to another,
right,
it might be higher
one,
or lower.
Yeah, the previous Endymion was an alto, so they had to hoik his music up a couple of steps so that the new guy could sing it.
Does that mean that the new guy was a castrato, probably?
Oh, they were both castrati, yes. Castrati normally sang the romantic leads in Baroque opera.
Which is why you'll often see, and I presume in this production, there's probably a woman singing the role. Or we might have a countertenor. I don't know who we've
yes,
got.
Yes, in the Illinois production, I believe it's double cast, and I believe there's one of them that will be a countertenor and the other will be a mezzo-soprano in the role of Endymion. Anyway, getting back
to the editing.
Yes. Okay, so problem one in editing is that this manuscript is a mess. And if you gave this to musicians today, they would say, cannot read a thing. Give me something I can read. And that was a problem that was faced by Raymond Leppard, The British conductor, who in the 1960s and 70s started digging around in the libraries in Venice and managed to find some scores of operas that had never been performed in modern times. And it's really thanks to him that in a lot of ways that the current interest in Baroque opera is ongoing, because he dug these things out of the library and put them on at Glyndebourne and really raised people's consciousness about how incredibly gorgeous the operas of Monteverdi and Cavalli were. Problem is that Raymond Leopard was at a point in history when he didn't think that modern audiences would respond very well to the strange new style, and so he recomposed the opera. And so he published an edition of La Callisto in 1970, and it is so thoroughly rewritten that the process of I started out making my edition. I thought, oh, this will be easy. I'll just photocopy Leopard's edition, and then I'll cut and paste and white out. No. It was just not possible. I had to start all over again. And it just made the whole process made me realize that although Leopard's edition was immensely popular and led to lots and lots of performances. In fact, your own Ricardo Herrera starred in a performance in that version at Juilliard, I believe. Nonetheless, it really is not representative of what Cavalli himself wrote. And so I got involved with this in 1986 when I was at the Eastman School of Music, and they were about to perform a version of Callisto from Leopard's edition. And I talked to the music director, and I'd sort of chat with him and sort of bring in an aria and said, well, you know, Diana has an aria in this scene. Do you think she'd like to sing that? And then I'd talk to Diana, and she said, hell yes. I want to sing an aria. And so I sort of gradually managed to convince the directors there at Eastman to introduce some version, some bits that were actual real Cavalli and not the rewritten Leopard version. And that was a lot of fun. It was a hoot to work with the cast there and really see this process of discovery as I was discovering this music too. And then later on, I went and made my own edition from scratch of the whole
opera. And that took how long?
Oh, don't ask.
I just did.
shall we say I started, it was published in 2007.
And you started the process in 1986, essentially.
Yeah, but I didn't work on it continuously that whole time.
Well, I hope
it was
not.
No. It was many stages, and actually, and a lot of it had to do with performing groups around the world who would call me up and say, "Hey, we want to do Callisto, but we don't have a tenor who can sing this part. So can you adapt it for a baritone?" And so I was
Just what Cavalli was
asked
to do.
Exactly. And I'm also thinking about what Raymond Leopard was doing, because a lot of the revisions that he made in the score was to enable his singers to work with it. So in a sense, it's all to stick to what Cavalli wrote is in some ways anachronistic, because opera was always a fluid genre, and so
he didn't stick with what he wrote.
He didn't stick with what he wrote. He couldn't, in some ways. But I think that it's important that performers today and scholars have a cooperative relationship, and we think about what things are realistic in terms of modern productions, but also think about how to make some revisions that are in the style of what Cavalli might have done, rather than rewriting it in the style of a symphony orchestra in circa 1970, which is rather more what Raymond Leopard did.
Well, you can hear this performance, this edition, the as close to the original as one could reasonably get at this point, or would want to. Given the forces available at the University of Illinois at this point, And it's going to go up tonight at 7:30 at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, La Callisto of Francesco Cavalli, with the addition by Jennifer Williams Brown. Let's introduce this next aria.
We're going to hear the big hit tune from this opera. This is sung by Endymion at the beginning of Act Two, as he is on the top of a mountaintop looking at the moon, and he's in love with the moon goddess, and he's singing this beautiful aria in worshiping his goddess. And of course, she's watching him too, and she's in love with him, and she comes down from heaven, and they have a nice little duet later on in the scene, but we'll just start with the opening aria.
And this is Derek Lee Reagan is the countertenor, along with Teatro Lirico is the name of the ensemble here, directed by Stephen Stubbs, music by Francesco Cavalli on Live and Local. Music from the opera La Callisto by Francesco Cavalli, sung here by countertenor Derek Lee Reagan with the Teatro Lirico directed by Stephen Stubbs on Live and Local. And La Callisto opens tonight at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Double cast, as I don't know in how many of the roles are double cast, but you can go see it twice if you want. Thursday through Saturday, 7:30 each evening, and then a Sunday matinee at 3 o'clock at the Krannert Center in Urbana. And we've been very pleased to have as our guest this portion of Live and Local, the editor of the opera that is being performed here, Jennifer Williams Brown, who is also a U of I graduate. So I'm sure it's nice to be back on campus.
Oh, yes. It's nice to be here and where I got my start in musicology, and to see the fruits of that labor being played out by all the students and faculty here. And it's a real honor.
And you just got here, so you actually haven't seen any of it yet. So
no, I haven't
seen
the show
yet. You get to see opening night. And
yeah, I've got tickets for all four nights, so I'm really excited.
So you get to compare the countertenor to the soprano. And
oh, we don't do that.
No, surely not.
We appreciate the gifts of each one.
There you go. Well put. Very diplomatic and democratic. Jennifer, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great talking to you, Kevin. Thank you so much.
And coming up on Live and Local, we'll be having members of the Robert E. Brown Center for World Music who are giving their spring concert on Saturday, also on the U of I campus in Urbana.
I'm David Teal from WILL-TV. Join me this October for a Friends of WILL tour of London, Yorkshire, and Wales. We'll see stately homes and splendid scenery with connections to some of our most popular TV programs. Three-night stays in each of our locales offer us plenty of free time. Call us at 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu for more information.
And we just heard a performance by the ensemble called Balkanalia, which is the Balkan Music Ensemble at the University of Illinois, directed by Donna Buchanan. And that was a dance tune from the Republic of Macedonia that opens this particular disc, The Best of Balkanalia, Volume 1. And it's quite a good ensemble. And that's one of the world music ensembles that exists at the University of Illinois. And the Robert E. Brown Center for World Music at the U of I is going to be giving its spring concert on Saturday in two parts. It's free admission for both parts of it. First program starts at 1, goes until 2:30, and will feature the Chinese Silk and Bamboo Ensemble, led by Priscilla Tse, and also two elements that we're going to hear samples of live in a moment, so I won't tell you what they are just yet. Second program starts at 3:30, goes till 5, and that includes a performance by the Balinese Gamelan and the Mande Percussion Ensemble. And those have become major features of. The director of the center is with us, Philip Jampolsky. And thanks for coming in and organizing our performers who we're going to hear in a bit.
Thank you. I'm happy to do so.
You have instruments in your hand.
Well, I've been pressed into service to back up the Mira people with the to hold a beat behind them later on.
And there's duct tape on these.
There is, yes. It's high fashion. it closes a hole in through which the seeds were inserted in the rattles.
Oh, that's a nice sound. I'm sure the duct tape affects the sound.
It's good to keep the duct tape off the sound, off the beads, actually. Hmm. Too many stick to it, then you lose it.
How do you go about putting together one of these extravaganzas? I mean, do you have a whole bunch of people you have to exclude from the program, or do you just try to put everybody you've got on somehow or another?
No, we have some ensembles that are directly sponsored and more or less maintained by the Center for World Music, the Balinese Gamelan, the Mande Ensemble, the Chinese Ensemble. And so we want to give them a chance to play. And then we ask other world music groups that exist in the community. And we try to vary those groups. At other times, we've had the Korean Samul Nori group and I forget the name of the Bossa Nova group, but we had them.
Bossa Nuevo?
I forget.
Desafinado
is what it was. And we've had the Russian and Middle Eastern ensemble. So there are lots of ensembles in the community that are doing wonderful world music, and we try to invite them to join in the concerts. We're trying to find a format. If we had everybody that's around, we would have 6 or 7 hour concerts. And
you kind of did that last year.
Well,
you had some outdoor component with some students.
That was at the Boneyard Festival.
Is that what that was?
And that worked fine because Boneyard, we had pretty much the whole day. Boneyard this year was so early. It was April 7th, which was a Thursday in the middle of the week, and it was so early that our groups, the Center's groups, were not ready to perform yet. So we decoupled from the Boneyard for this year and came later in the month. And as I say, we're trying to find a format, and we didn't want to do just a seven-hour concert. So we're experimenting now with two separate programs.
Well, it's almost kind of exciting, too, you know, from as people discover the center and discover these concerts to maybe not know what the format's going to be.
Perhaps. it makes us a little nervous. But we would like to invite more and more of these wonderful ensembles that are out in the community, like the two that you've got in your studio right now.
It's a nice lead-in since we've got these folks here. And you guys are playing an instrument. There are four of you playing an instrument that I was introduced to my freshman year at Northwestern by Paul Berliner. And I think we've probably talked about this. Tom Torino is a professor of musicology at the U of I and does a lot of performing himself of different kinds, very different kinds of music, including Cajun and kind of old-time Americana sorts of things. And it's funny that there's duct tape on these rattles because I remember that Paul always had kind of bells, shakers, duct taped to his shoes
right.
when he would play. And he would have the umbira, which I'm going to get you to describe in a moment, you know, in behind a resonating unit that I see you have also here, a big hollowed-out gourd. Which, oh, now that's interesting. It's got rattles around it that appear to be beer bottle caps.
Yes.
Some shells. So this is called sort of found percussion in a way.
Well, no. And you also, I mean, they use bottle caps now.
Really?
They used to use shells, and they would have to go to the coast because Zimbabwe. So I guess a little bit about this. Mbira is from Zimbabwe. The kind of macro linguistic term that they use for the social group is Shona. So Shona Imbira, and it's a 22-key thumb piano, as Americans say, with three kind of registers, a high, medium, and low register bass notes. And this is really the classical instrument of Zimbabwe. So Zimbabwe was landlocked, but the rattles... So this is how the instrument sounds outside the resonating gourd. And inside the gourd, which on Saturday we'll be playing inside these gourds, they have a big calabash gourd.
Much fuller sound.
Much fuller, much louder. But we decided for the radio that we would play in a more whisper fashion.
Well, and Mike Pritchard can work his magic, and it'll probably sound huge to our listeners. I don't know.
So, there are four of us here, and this music is played in two parts or more. And there's a beginning lead part and then a follow part. That interlocks with it so that the notes are alternated. And the Imbira part just cycles around for a while, and then the kind of emphasis is really on the singing. So we've been working on that as a group. So would you like to hear a song?
After I introduce your colleagues. So we have Tom Farina, of course, and then Catherine Hennessy, Claire Johnson, and Mike Warner, all playing the Imbira, which is spelled, by the way, M-B-I-R-A. So you just sort of hum the first letter,
yeah,
and then say the rest.
This is a tune called Nyamaropa, meat and blood.
Nice. Do we want to know what you're actually saying?
How's the tempo for it? Yeah.
That was very catchy, actually. Sort of hypnotic, almost.
Well, this music, you know, it's hard to do it in this. You don't play these tunes for 3 minutes. You play them for 20 minutes, and the singing actually emerges from the embita part. So we have some parts that we kind of know, but the best singing actually comes out of the music after you've been playing it for about 10 minutes. And it's really, that's the fun part, actually.
Is it sort of like it comes out of a trance in a way? I mean, it's almost, I can imagine this music putting you into some sort of space, and then all of a sudden...
Yeah,
actually, out comes the rest.
I hate to say it, but it's true. That's what happens. I mean, it's, we got together early this morning because I can't sing this music unless it has actually come out of a certain place in me, and I can't just kind of do it. Yeah. I can't just kind of turn it on. So it's, the best is like when after you've gone, this is not really presentational music. It's not music for concert. It's music for ceremony. So it's actually religious ceremonies, spirit possession ceremonies, and you play these things for a long time, and yeah, I don't know. Others speak. You are nodding your head, Claire.
Yeah, it's very trance-like. The longer you play it, I guess.
Have you had any opportunities to play this kind of music in a traditional context?
Well, I did. I played in spirit possession ceremonies. You play all night. Your thumbs get really raw.
What is a spirit possession ceremony?
Well, it's a ceremony where an ancestor comes into a medium, a family member who's alive, and the ancestor talks to the family.
And is it drawn out by the music?
There's three things. 7-day beer that the family brews. Snuff, which is taken through the nose in good 19th century fashion, and embita music. And the embita music is really one of the main, and you have to play the songs that the ancestors really liked. So it's one of the inducements in. So, and you know, somebody living remembers, it's usually ancestors 2 or 3 generations back or 1 generation back, somebody will remember what their favorite song was, and so you have to play that. So the way we play this, it sounds very delicate this way. When you play in the gourd, it drives it a little bit more. And the other key instrument in Zimbabwe are the ones that Philip has, which are the hosho. These are shakers. And we can do another one quickly with the beat. This is called Nema Masasa, cutting branches for a temporary shelter. again, 2 parts. Who's going to play second on this? Okay. So... And this, we'll have more singing in this, I hope.
Thank you.
place to stop.
Or start, probably, for that matter.
He stopped when he hits his foot.
Yeah. Tom Torino with Catherine Hennessy, Claire Johnson, Mike Warner, who were... Are there more members of the Imbira Ensemble?
There are. There's about twice as many.
Right.
And I actually have two groups. I have a beginning group, and this is the group that's been playing a couple of years.
We've
been
playing about 2 years.
2 years together. And I have one. So I start, although now I've got two going, so I'm not going to start a new one next year. But
And they're going to be part three of the first program by the Robert E. Brown Center for World Music in the spring concert on Saturday. Their program starts at 1 until about 2:30. There's an hour break, and then a second program with the gamelan and the percussion ensemble at 3:30. And this is all happening at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor, West Illinois Street. And you're listening to Live and Local. We're very pleased that they were able to come in and give at least a sample of the sound of this music. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring the powerful fervor of tenor Ben Heppner on Thursday, April 28th. That's tonight at 7:30. More information is at krannertcenter.com. And we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 2 to 6 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. This Saturday's tasting features Lee Mabry of The Cream Wine Company, with a lineup of their wines from around the world. More information is at thecorkscrew.com. This is Illinois Public Media, WYLFM, and HD1 and HD2 Urbana, with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville. And we had a lot less time than I had hoped for you guys, so what I'm going to do is just ask Tom to take us out with a little sample of this instrument that you have in your hand called the charango from... Yeah.
From Peru and Bolivia. So Kate Hathaway and I are going to be playing at 1:30. And we'll be playing Andean music, which is one of my other loves. And this is just a little stringed instrument we do. We're going to have a flute, and it sounds like this.